Since everybody's here, I think we'll kick off. We're up to Allenby Farms. Commissioner Monroe.
Okay. Following the answers we've given over the morning, I can understand how, in the context of an outstanding natural landscape, the existence of urban development could be so detrimental to landscape values that one might no longer consider an ONL to exist. Could you take me through how the same principle would apply in the case of an ONF like Mount Iron? And even if it had houses all over it, would it still not be an ONF?
I think in the case of an outstanding natural feature, if there were houses all over it...
Sorry, could you sit the microphone?
Sorry, please.
Just on the wee box in front of you, eh?
That either?
Not sure.
Speak. We need a test.
Yep. Is that better now? I think in that case, if it was covered with houses, then it would no longer be natural enough to be an outstanding natural feature. In the same way that I talked earlier about the fact that an urban area, I didn't think an urban area that was an urban landscape entirely could be classified as an outstanding natural landscape.
I guess what I'm saying is that I can understand the clear relationship between urban development and landscape values. But Mount Iron is still Mount Iron. As a natural feature, it hasn't been quarried, hasn't been mined, hasn't been cut into. Its integrity as a feature, as a geological feature, would remain almost entirely intact, would it not? Or, I'm trying to distinguish the difference between an ONL and an ONF.
Okay, yeah. I agree that the feature of Mount Iron extends beyond the area that is classified as an ONF in the proposed district plan, but the modification by roading, earthworks, building platforms, houses and other domestic alterations to the landscape have meant that part of the feature could not be included in the ONF classification.
In terms of the submission, and despite the various reports and evidence that's been exchanged, what seems to still be being pursued by the submitter a form of SNA substitution. Now, SNA is not near your expertise, but in terms of the frequency with which these things tend to happen around ONLs and ONS, is that a practice you've seen people do before, trying to substitute or replace?
I'm not familiar with that.
No.
I haven't seen it before.
No.
Not familiar. Not in my area of expertise.
I suppose that's because it's a bit difficult to replace a landscape, whereas it's more viable to replace vegetation.
I was wondering if it was something you'd come across.
Yeah.
The submission for the housing lots, which you're opposed to, is it the visual effects that you're primarily concerned with, or a more fundamental cumulative /enough/integrity of the environment?
I think in this case it's both. I suppose the natural character, the effect of that development on the natural character of the feature and the visual effects of the dwelling.
Thank you, sir.
You're just wondering about the entrance to Wanaka, having been through both the 2020 process and moving forward with that, and that as you come into and would be you come up on the river, you see Mount High, and that takes your eye. You drive down the State Highway 6, and the open area basically from if you looked at you go past Pumping World, and on your right you've got the car park that leads up to the Mount High walkway, which is one of the most walked walks in New Zealand. Would you draw a distinction between essentially the space below that car park and the space above backwards towards?
Where I'd see is I think it's important to retain the openness next to the road from where houses are no longer visible.
Yes.
On the ridge above. So that's probably further down towards Wanaka than just, you know, there's quite a gap between the car park and that point.
And that openness, currently there's essentially a, I'll call it a road reserve, a fence, and then there's the alum, the NBR and BRA. That would include the building restriction area, or would it be sufficient just the bit that's the road reserve, if you see what I mean?
My concern was about views towards Nandoyan as you're leaving Wanaka, and so if there was development in the BRA in that area, it would be in the foreground of your views towards Nandoyan.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. And the if you look at the Mount Iron as it is, there is Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron.
Yes.
And Little Mount Iron has a lot more built form on it. And in terms of if that continued, you're actually just following on from the conversation you were having with Commissioner Munro, the more houses, the less of an ONF actually becomes. Is that the case? Is that a fair conclusion to come to?
I think there are some houses within the current ONF as notified, but my concern is about the cumulative effects of more houses on that feature, you know, within the boundary that's defined as an ONF.
And even without the houses, the what accompanies the houses, the
breakup right, and the domestic activities and planting and
exotic planting for this week. Thank you.
Now, in terms of taking that, Mr. McLeod's few points, you talked about the views with the Allenby land of the foreground that used in that iron going east out of town. Over the weekend.
Pardon?
Over the weekend, I strolled up alongside that and then strolled back again to try and get a sense of what your evidence was about. And I could understand exactly what you meant about what you just said. We don't have to go there. The thing that I noticed, because it was a brilliantly blue sky day on Saturday, was that as you walk into town, I can understand the entrance issue. The other thing that I noticed, and I wondered if you had a view about, was that as you come down the hill with the Allenby land on the right, the Allenby land is in the foreground of your view of Black Peak,
So I wondered if you thought about the implications of that.
I hadn't, I must admit.
Okay. Only happens, of course, when we've got brilliant blue sky day, which, of course, is every second day in Wanaka. That in terms of the point at that we discussed, that you were discussing with Commissioner Monroe about whether it's sufficiently natural to be part of an ONF or an ONL,
mm-hmm.
I want to change the focus a little. We'll come to this talking about the ONF at the confluence of the Hawea River, Hawea Kruka River. And you've given evidence about whether the ONL should come to the top of the floodbanks. My question is, if it weren't for the urban development of Albertown, would you in fact draw the ONL at the top of the next ridge line currently occupied by a sea of houses?
I haven't looked at that in detail, but I do remember Dr. Reid discussed that in her original landscape boundaries report, saying that while there was a terrace in Albertown, that if there had been no urban development, that would have been included in the ONL. Because of the urban development, the ONL goes along the boundary of that township. But I haven't examined that in detail myself.
Because on the face of it, there is an inconsistency in which terrace line you're picking on the Hawea side of the confluence compared to the Albertown side. You go a lot further, about two terraces further up, going up State Highway 6 to where what's enclosing the river compared to the Albertown side.
I understand that. I didn't look at that in detail at Albertown, but I understand that was because of the presence of the township. And also on the other side, on the true left bank, the line I've defined there is a continuous escarpment that carries on from further up the Hawea at the same level. So it was drawing the line consistently at the top of that escarpment.
Now, going back to Mount Iron, 347, you're discussing the fact that the ONF line is in fact a larger area than Mount Iron. The last sentence, you think it's more logical.
Sorry, which?
347 of your evidence in chief.
My evidence.
Oh, sorry, 747.
747.
747,
I've got it.
Page 33. I'm not helping by giving you the wrong paragraph number. But the question for you is, pursuing Commissioner Monroe's line of thinking, is this inconsistent? Like, I can understand you contracting an ONF because parts of it are insufficiently natural, but expanding it beyond the ambit of the feature, the question would be, is that a landscape position or is that a planning position?
I would say it's probably more of a planning position. though I do note that that strip of land there is under plain management, and has similar vegetation to Mandaline itself, but in terms of the topographical edge of the feature, it is inside that line.
It's also pretty properly academic, since no, there are no submissions shifted. Going for your rebuttal evidence, 3.23, you're talking about changing from the issue about whether some of the species proposed by the submitter will in fact be able to be, will be viable in that environment. The issue I'm going to discuss with, and later you talk about whether they would in fact stick out, because currently it's a, like a sea of deep green kanuka. I'm going to explore this with Mr. Davis, but his evidence, it's like, well, part of the, part of Dr. Lloyd's criticism of the SNA is that Kanuka is not in fact the natural cover, and Mr. Davis responds to that and say, no, that's right, because it would have been much more varied, and the Kanuka is representative of the natural cover. I think it must follow, and I'll ask you to assume this, because the order Mr. Davis is coming after you. Assuming that the natural cover was a mixture of indigenous species, and presumably they're not all deep green, so if they were there naturally, presumably they could re-establish over time, given the sufficient encouragement, and as you say, a bit of rabbit-proof fencing. So the question is, is it as black and white as you pictured it? If you could find, if you had a list of indigenous species that were in fact originally on Mount Iron, presumably they will grow again, and presumably the difference from that deep green is making it more and not less natural. So I'll put that proposition to you and invite you to comment.
I can't really speak as to the ecological
So I'm asking you to assume that, because I'm going to test that with Mr. Davis. But if he says that
they are appropriate, yes, they may be appropriate ecologically, but I still consider that in the current environment they would create an unnatural pattern because of the existing kanuka and the dotted building platforms amidst that kanuka.
Well, there's also the question about whether the non-kanuka natural vegetation would be just as flammable as the kanuka.
I don't have knowledge of that.
That's another gem, no doubt Mr. Davis will be able to assist us with. I should ask you to tease that out, your answer out a little more, because I have rolling around in my memory comments from the Environment Court about the effect of losing exotic trees that are currently valued. I'm reaching, and I can't remember that, but the context is, for argument's sake, in Wakatipu Basin, where there are lines of poplars. If you were to replace them with indigenous trees, I don't know what, I think they're talking about kauai trees that were natural on Mount Iron, so presumably they were present on Wakatipu Basin. Would that have, would you have a similar landscape objection to that?
They're having kauai trees on
Mount Iron. Yeah. Well, let's just take that. Just,
I wouldn't have any objection as long as the planting of those kauai trees was in a pattern that, you know, approximated, you know, the original frequency of and distribution of kauai trees, you know, on that landform, which I'm not sure whether we really know.
I'll ask Mr. Davis that question, but I think that as I read what you're saying is that the issue with, from a landscape point of view, about revegetation is this a sort of a false indigenous pattern that would never have been there naturally, or does it actually represent what it would naturally have looked like? Is that fair?
Yes, my concern is the pattern of that vegetation, which is in patches around each proposed dwelling.
So, like, literally islands?
Yes.
In the sea of deep green?
Yes.
Whereas if it were spread all over the hillside, that might not be the same issue.
No, if it was a natural pattern of that vegetation, I wouldn't have this effect.
Oh, that's all. Now let's see what's next. Skir et al. Starting at page paragraph 759.
I think we've got Orchard Road Holdings and Jackie Redo before we get to Skir.
Oh, I'm looking in the wrong half of the page. Thank you for that. Orchard Road and Jackie Redeye, yes, indeed. So, go back, Steve. Does that mean you have a question on Orchard Road? Give us an answer.
Just bear with me, I need to find some notes. No, thank you.
No? Well, I did. You prompted me. In that section, I was interested as we drove out down Riverbank Road because we saw those large sections that Ms. Red Eye and her fellow submitters have in the Piercy Vineyard. Over the road, although well hidden, the trees seems to be a much, much denser degree of development.
Yes, it's a different zoning. The Red Eye land is rural zone, and across the other side of the land is, and would need confirmation, but I think rural lifestyle.
Rural lifestyle, isn't it?
Yes. And it also, that rural lifestyle appears more dense than it may otherwise, because the sections go down over Cardrona Escarpment and onto the Cardrona floodplain, so the amount of land available for building on Riverbank Road is quite small, and so houses appear more concentrated along that stretch.
because they're all located on the top terrace.
Yes.
And as I understand your reasoning, that's why you have an issue with the suggestion that further down Riverbank Road on the east, it should be upzoned.
Yes.
For the same reason.
For that reason, and also because of the potential for more development in the floodplain of the Cadrona River. There is already some development, especially on the southern part of that Riverbank Road rural lifestyle area that is on the floodplain.
And given, going back up the road towards the Red Eye blocks of land, your conclusion is you consider the rural residential land would result in a loss of the remaining rural character in the landscape setting of southeastern Wanaka.
Mm.
And it seemed a bit odd to me where you have, as you say, rural lifestyle, but with the much denser appearance than that zoning would suggest, on the rural side of Wanaka, and you're saying that developing it inside that would result in a loss of rural character. Maybe I'm missing something, but can you just talk me through that? It seems, is the theory that this is open space before you get to that dense relative?
No, it was more that I considered that rural residential zoning, which is what the submitters are seeking, would be have considerably less rural character than either rural zoning or rural lifestyle zoning for that area of land.
Or any other rural, so you wouldn't be comfortable with rural lifestyle zoning in that land either?
Yes, I've said in my evidence that I know it's not sought, but I would be comfortable with rural lifestyle zoning of that area.
Well, we'll ask Mr. Barr whether he'd be comfortable with that too.
Just from a landscape perspective.
Yes, indeed. Well, having jumped ahead, we're now on Skua. I know that Commissioner Monroe has had a question.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Could I just ask a follow-up question?
Oh, before
we leave, Ms. Nelson, you said that you see the rural residential development on the east side of Riverbank Road as being relatively, it has the appearance of being more intensive than the zoning. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Before you go on, yeah. I think you may have mistaken, Commissioner. I think it's rural lifestyle on the east side that appears more to
looking at the
zoning
map, there are sections that are rural lifestyle and sections that are rural residential. So maybe I'd better ask you to clarify. Is it both parts? Have you got a copy of the zoning map? Otherwise, I'll pass it over.
It's map 18. Right there.
Which has the southern.
No, it is all rural lifestyle rather than rural residential.
Until, yeah, okay. It's all rural lifestyle. My observation when we did a site visit is that there's quite a dense planting along the road frontage on Riverbank Road.
Yes.
And that from that viewing point along the road, wherever you are along it, there's actually relatively little evidence of the residential dwelling from the curtilages behind it.
Mm.
You're nodding, so you would agree with that, that the existing greening does.
Do you mean on the right hand?
Looking, yeah, the right hand side as you're driving towards the north.
Yes.
Towards Mount Iron.
Towards Mount Iron.
I think No, I do think you get quite a sense that there's a row of dwellings along that edge on the right-hand side of the road, on the edge of the Cardrona escarpment. You can see a number of houses. They're screened by vegetation, but it has the feeling of a more domestic area because of the houses and the kind of garden planting that's there.
Okay, well, a couple of things that I'd just like to get a better understanding of. If that is the case, mm-hmm. then are you saying that allowing a rural residential zoning would have a greater effect of creating that sense of more residential, more intensive residential than even the rural lifestyle?
Yes, I think the rural residential zoning would, it has significantly less open space, retained open space than the rural lifestyle zone, and much less capacity for open paddocks or even for significant planting because of the size of the lots in rural residential.
Well, that was what the other part of the question. So you don't see that there's the opportunity to achieve satisfactory mitigation visually with planting. I mean, I would have thought a 2,000 square metre lot would be quite generous in terms of getting sufficient planting around a dwelling and any open space. If the zone rules required it, then you have to confirm that.
Yeah, my opinion is still that with rural residential, because of the density, you can't achieve the same level of rural character as with rural lifestyle.
And
even with planting.
All right, and you may have commented, and I've just missed it, but the view from the other side of the river within the rural zone from the east side of the river, that would clearly create a completely different impression of Riverbank Road, wouldn't it? That's a lot more development visible from there on the other.
Yes, well, for the houses that are on the edge, that because they're at a lower level on that side of the river, they're kind of looking up towards them.
So is your concern as much about the view from that side as from Riverbank Road itself?
In relation to
the pattern of development that's already occurred within the rural lifestyle zone.
Well,
I should possibly turn it around and say, just to put it to you, is there a significant difference in what you see from Riverbank Road versus the other side of the river?
I don't think so, really. The road access on the other side of the river is back further from the river, so I haven't visited, you know, a lot of the properties that are right by the river, and I'm not sure exactly, you know, how much development is visible from there, but I don't think that's necessarily more important than views from Riverbank Road.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so we are on the Sker et al. Submission. Commissioner Hudson, do you have any issues on this section? So starting 759.
No, we've got a question from Mr. Barr, but not under for anything else.
Commissioner Frank?
No, I don't think so. This is sort of the area that you're looking at. When you were talking about rural lifestyle is a change from urban to rural, and this would almost typify this sort of area where it's appropriate. Yeah, I'm fine with that. Let's see.
My question is, and it may have been somewhere else, I have this horrible feeling you may already have answered this question, well, I can't remember where, but I'll ask it anyway. Mr. Barr's considered your suggestion that to preserve the view shaft and basically said from planning in planning terms it's all too hard. That's, he put it much more eloquently than that. But he suggested an extensive building restriction area along Cadrona Valley Road. Do you have a view of the on the extent to which that would mitigate any adverse effects of development in that group of sites that are listed in Table 1?
I think it would definitely assist with any effects of buildings blocking the view. There's still a possibility that, you know, very tall growing vegetation associated, that would be, anyone could plant as permitted activity, could obscure those views. That could also happen at the moment. People could plant vegetation that would obscure the view. It would make it more likely that vegetation associated with dwellings was set further back and less likely to obscure the view of the mountains.
Thank you. We're up to the Willow Ridge Industrial Development. No questions? Alright, going to the Blennerhassett parties. That's the UBG, the UGB rebate had to follow Ruby Island Road starting 770 if you're in it. No?
I have one question, but it's probably for Ms. Scott. Ms. Nelson, you state in 770 that it's assumed that some form of urban zoning is sought by the submitter, but I actually wondered whether there'd been confirmation of what they were seeking.
Without evidence or from hearing from the submitter, I don't think there's been any specific request. They've just asked for a residential zoning without saying exactly what zone they are after. That's my understanding.
So, yeah, thank you. We'll have to ask the submitter.
We might even have to read the submission.
It's unlikely to be heavy industrial, though, really, is it?
No, I don't think they've got that much to go.
I had a question, really a clarification, with a reference in your 771 to a Q2 covenant of Kanuka, and I wondered if you could point out where that is on the site.
It's on the, I don't know if I have an aerial photo, I don't know if I've got an aerial photograph of that site. It's on the slopes going down towards the lake, and so it adjoins the lakefront preserve and goes up the escarpment.
It's kind of in this area here. This is it here actually, yes. As you can see, the O&L line takes it in.
Oh,
so
it's this bit of land here.
Yep. This is why the O&L line tank, I believe, is it?
Yes, where that tank is in the O&L line.
Gotcha. next we have the Maisie Family Trust. Easy takers. Purdy et al. You're putting silence on my left and right. And then we go to the rural area. Glendine. So lovely. Mr. Hudson? Any thoughts about Glendine? Any rough share?
I'm still finding my place there.
Right. Last question. Cloud, what was your fault in that?
A relatively convenient no build zone. I'll just get there. And there's the street. Oh, this is the Glendine Homestead.
Yes.
Yes. As opposed to Glendine Holdings. So you did draw a distinction between Glendine Homestead and Glendine Holdings. In terms of the Glendine Homestead was looking at, was actually seen as having been less impactful. And am I reading that correct?
Yes, well there's three kind of submissions,
yes,
along there. So Glendine Homestead, then Leslie and Jerry Burden,
mm-hmm,
and then the camping ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're because the rezoning saw a Glendine Homestead already had built for, then it was more appropriate. Was that essentially the gist of the onion?
Yes, because it's already a homestead cluster,
yep,
and an expected homestead cluster in that environment, and also has a lot of trees and is separated from the highway by a landform, then it has ability to absorb additional development there.
And assuming, and again, just from my head, that one of the arguments for, and this is mixing the two submissions again, and I apologise, but the was the Glendine Holdings, which is the four house lots.
It's Leslie and Jerry Burden.
Leslie and Jerry Burden.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you would see the road and you'd see the any plantings they put around those buildings, and that would lead you to suspect that there were houses there, and that's the reason for not doing it. Whereas in the homestead, which is essentially that, but it's about 40 years on, that's a reason for doing it.
Well, it's also about the kind of sprawl of development,
yes,
along the edge. So the Glendine Homestead development will be concentrated in a cluster with existing development, whereas the other four would be extending development along the lake edge in a kind of, you know, sprawl, extending it out from the existing cluster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a bit confused about using the, and I can see your reasoning when you combine it with others, but using one for and one against, that was what I was trying to get clear in my head. Thank you.
No, thank you, sir.
Well, can we talk about then the campground? The Glendine campground session. Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you, sir.
And Commissioner Cloud?
No, that's pretty clear.
My question from the staff office, you talk about your 4.47 of your rebuttal evidence. So the only part of this lot that has potential to absorb built development without compromising additional amenity values is the lower sycamore covered area immediately adjacent to the existing campground activities. You identify on a plan, I suppose we don't have one conveniently, where you're talking about, like, how big an area is that? Like, it's accepting that it's immediately adjacent, so I know where the campground is.
I haven't measured that area.
But approximately?
to him?
This is where?
This is the front,
yes, it is. This is a...
Enlargement.
Where did we get this from?
That'd probably be from
here. Those are all our sites of it.
Number five.
Would you like me to approach?
Yes, indeed. Hang on. Kindly provided. Join our site visit.
Okay, so the part I'm talking about is quite a small area. And it's this part down here. It's at the back of the campground there. So this has got a lot of sycamores on it down here, and it slopes down pretty steeply from the road down here, and then it's like this flatter area at the back.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So the back of the campground is sort of between the road and the campground itself.
Yeah.
Burden Senior, Commissioner Jury. Blake and Christ Station. So we'll start with the O&L boundary. Any more? Never mind, I started with it.
I've got a general question. As you pointed out in the evidence, the upper slopes of the Lake Mackay Station that are in cultivation are being used for that purpose, the pasture, essentially pasture. Based on what you said this morning, this is sort of speculative, I suppose, but if any of those upper slopes were then to be used for a different form of farming that included the pivot, this may be hypothetical because of the topography and so on, but if they were to be used for pivot irrigation, would that change your view about the effect of the land use in that particular situation?
No, it changed my view. A lot of the land up there is already being irrigated, but with K-line irrigators,
yes,
rather than pivot irrigators. But that means that there are, you know, green patches of crops and irrigated grass in that area, and I did take that into account when making my assessment.
Yes, thank you.
I don't have any expertise, but I'm not sure if there's enough contiguous, flat enough areas for pivot irrigation in that area.
Yeah. I don't have any other questions.
I had a question arising out of your summary that I should have asked you this morning. You referred to the bald developments.
Yeah.
Can you identify on a plan where exactly the site of that proposed development is?
The map that was attached to my my understanding is that the board development site is the site that's immediately west of the district boundary.
At what elevation?
I'm not sure how far up the slope the bald site goes, but my understanding was that it does go quite a long way up that boundary. but we could confirm that. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact boundaries.
Bukarangi
knows the one on the LBC side of the boundary that the High Court bowled because it was only no one out.
There you go. Fair enough.
We can find out then.
If you could do that, please, because given that you rely on it, I think it's important that we know exactly where it is, in particular how low down. It's not how high it is, but how low it is that I'm interested in. Given that the court found that the whole lot was in the ONL. Miss Scott, if you would add that to your list of songs. Now, next, the LMS proposed development areas. Kelly suggested that you were inconsistent in your application of the principles identifying needs or excluding the knob that's in the front corner of the LMS hill country. His argument is that he thinks you're inconsistent with the approach you've taken to that compared to the LMS mid-run, what he calls the mid-run area, which I think is the irrigated terraces. So I invite you to respond if you feel the need.
Well, I think I've expressed in my evidence the reasons why I consider that it should not be included, and I've done that in the interest of consistency.
In the absence of landscape evidence from LMS, we'll leave that there. The development here of LMS development options. Is there anything there?
Nothing.
I have a question for you arising out of this VARS recommendation in relation to the Atkins Road rural residential zone. VAR has an issue with the north side, that part of the called Area 2, I think it's Area 2, that extends down the hill to the north side of Atkins Road. Do you share that view on landscape grounds?
I think I said in my evidence that I could support the rural residential zoning on that side, mainly on the basis that it's quite a small area and there's already an existing dwelling there. I do agree with that it would extend, you know, further outside of that boundary of Atkins Road. I did support it on the basis that it was quite small and touched against the escarpment.
The other question I have is a variation of one I've already asked you on another property. 8.38, Area 3, in your opinion, some limited development could be absorbed if it wasn't visible from the wider basin. When you mean the wider basin, you mean from the opposite side of the river?
Yes.
And some terms of development, how much are we talking about?
It's a very small area, and I think, I can't remember, I think it's the zoning sort only would allow two or three dwellings there.
I have an idea it might be 6 hectares. That sticks in my mind. But that's just from memory.
Sorry, is this my recommendation, my recommended area?
No, this is moved to area 3.
Okay, sorry.
Area 8.3 acres. Moved south, north up to Kellerans.
I'll find a map.
I suppose the point is that do you think it's slightly more than it has been a 6 hectare sort, and if so, how long is it?
I think the three dwellings represents what I've described as limited.
Well, complete in a circle. Does that mean, given that that's all an RL zone on that particular pocket of land would permit, that you wouldn't have an issue with it from a landscape perspective?
What I considered is that would be acceptable if the houses were not visible, but I'm not sure if that can be assured with the rural lifestyle zoning.
See if Mr. Kelly can assure us of that. Going to Cooper. One question for you, Ms. Mousehoff. If you turn to your figure 8, I understand the arguments, pros and cons, both of the area to the east and around the confluence. There are two strange, I hesitate to describe them, disturbing the natural terrace, the one that's more at the bottom edge, you suggested that it's like an arc sticking up, and you suggested that be ruled off at the bottom, and I can understand that having been driven up that gap. But there's a second one that sticks from left to right of them. What is that feature? And what is
it? To the north of that.
Yes.
That's the terminal moraine of the next last glaciation, Hauea glaciation. It's a very prominent feature, and that part that's included in the O&L is the part of that moraine that's been eroded by the Hauea River, and it's a very prominent and distinctive feature within the basin. Further to the east,
it hasn't been eroded so steeply by the Hawea River, and it's has quite a significant amount of rural living development on it.
Thanks for that. Right. Move to Forest and Bird, the rural residential zone on top of Coolidge Bank, starting at 8x2. Mr. Hudson?
No.
Any thoughts?
No, all good, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Nothing from me. We'll move on to Sunny Heights. Mr. Hudson, anything from you?
Not for this round of the PDP, maybe for the next one I might have some questions.
Having moved on, I did have one residual question about Keeper. I wonder if you assist me in your rebuttal evidence, I'm flicking from one to the other. You discussed whether the Mr. Espy's argument that the Clutha River corridor is not large enough to be a landscape in its own right, and you should observe it's certainly long enough. What would, in terms of the lines you've drawn, what would its approximate minimum and maximum width be?
I'm not sure of the maximum, but the minimum is under the 1 hectare that that Mr. Espy talked about in his and so, you know, strictly it doesn't meet those guidelines that were set out in that Environment Court case. But I've discussed in that paragraph 4.18 that's why I consider still appropriate.
I suppose the obvious question would be, how much less than 1 kilometre? Is it 0.5 kilometre? Is it 800 metres? Like, and if you don't know, then tell us, then we'll have, well.
I haven't quantified that distance yet.
I wonder if Council could add that to the list, because if we're going to suggest adopt Ms. Malsoff's reasoning, I think we'd better know how far under the indicative width that is, because obviously the further.
I'm sorry, I have measured it and I haven't written it down.
I understand.
I haven't measured it.
So I suspect, given we've got plans for Africa, and it won't take long. So if you could advise, please, you're not looking down to the last metre, but sort of plus or minus a few, but not plus or minus 100.
Now, I just wanted, in relation to Sunny Heights, I just wanted to get clear in my mind, you talk at 8.57 about the western wall of Dublin Bay meltwater channel and the outwash terraces. And I wanted you please to explain what are those, basically what are those concepts geologically, and secondly what do they look like, because you provided me with a graph, with a photo, and I'm thinking yes. What is that?
I think it needs a little geological knowledge to recognise those features.
And perhaps maybe it is at the point.
yes, I think so. In my understanding, I'm not a geologist, a meltwater channel is a channel formed from the outflow at the end of a glacier. So where the water comes, is melting under the glacier and flows out, it forms a channel coming out. And so in that location, on the eastern side of that moraine at Dublin Bay, there is a meltwater channel, and the photograph in photograph 10 is looking straight down that meltwater channel with the eroded moraine. Is that vegetated area on the right and in the mid-ground. That's the eroded edge of that channel into the moraine. As you go further east on that site, the meltwater channel gets wider and opens up, and there are still edges to that meltwater channel, but it's also been modified by subsequent action of the river into terraces that also step down.
And in the notified plan, I think that reads as obviously a channel is you've got defined RLC on each side of map 18, and you've just decided that you've formed the view that your recommendation to us is that channel is not sufficiently distinctive at that point.
Yes, from a landscape point of view, yes.
And therefore you just effectively join the dots.
Yes,
I
have, yes.
And the other question is, by eye, it looks like, to me, like, to the west of that, the lines that are drawn on the PDP are the lines that the Environment Court drew and are currently in the ADP, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, the last question I should ask you is about the area in the confluence, and the photos that Mr. Espy has produced, and indeed your photo 9, suggest that area identified as an ONL, although geographically distinctive with the terraces, it's pretty scrubby land.
Scrubby might be called a pejorative term.
Well, possibly.
and it may indicate high ecological values.
Well, yes, indeed. Is that your evidence that it does have?
I haven't assessed the ecological significance of that, but I consider that that area of land is no more modified than many other areas of RNL land within the Confluent area and the Cruiser River corridor.
Thank you. Now, Jeremy Bell, Crafton Station. Let's start on the airport end. Submission 782. Commissioner Hudson.
No, they're not in relation to the airport.
Commissioner Clark.
It's an interesting distinction you draw between the area removed from proposed from a landscape perspective and the area that's not. Coming up from the cutting to the escarpment and the rationale, I wonder if you could expand on your rationale for doing that. Obviously, that's the bit that you, it's more open aspect, that's just after the entrance to Lake Mackay Station, near up.
Yes, it's more that as you're from State Highway 6, as you're driving east, you get quite wide open views out from that part of the road, and they are open and rural, those views.
But I wouldn't disagree with you there, but your view is predominantly to the left.
Yes.
Looking to the right is... I wouldn't even say your eyes drawn to the right. It's more you've driven past that.
I agree that the focus of the view is to the distance view,
yeah.
But it's still within the view.
Still
yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
The following on from that, thinking that. At that point, I was trying to recall my own experience driving along that road. I suppose I was looking at the road. It seemed quite an enclosed view with the hillside right in behind. So you described it as a wide open view, which is why I reacted. It didn't seem wide open to me.
Open, it's wide open to the east and to the northeast,
yeah.
Enclosed by the escarpment on the south side of the road.
Steve, all right. Jay Bell, second submission about development sites. 8:20.
Commissioner Hudson. Yes, Mark. So, when we did our site visit, there was evidence of planting on third terrace above the flat land.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your conclusion is that you don't support in rural residential rezoning, but I wondered whether you've taken into account the existing use of that part of the submitted site for planting, whether you had a view of an opinion about the any
sort of landscape. When I undertook my site visit, there was no glamping. I wasn't shown a glamping site, I suppose. I was unaware of a glamping site.
It was next to the dead deer. I don't know if you know.
It's funny,
that's all. That rural character.
Yeah. And I think what I've said in my evidence is that I think there is some capacity for, you know, some development there, but it needs to be very carefully located and of a lower density than a rural lifestyle density, and I consider that the rural zone provisions would be the appropriate way of managing part of the landscape.
One thing that doesn't seem to have come up anywhere directly is whether or not temporary activities like glamping or camping, whether they have an effect on the landscape, it's going to be different from permanent.
They do have an effect, but their effect is always much less because of their temporary nature, because they're reversible and not permanently in the landscape, then the magnitude of that effect is much smaller.
Mm.
You may get a few arguments with regard to freedom camping in this part of
the
woods.
It's nearly permanent.
Yeah.
So, I don't have any other questions. Thank you, sir.
My question, Ms. Melzer, is that there are, to my mind, well, it's one development proposal. You've got an upper and a lower terrace. You've addressed the proposal globally. Do you think that the proposed development lands on the lower terraces have the same landscape issues as the upper terrace? And is there more scope for development on the lower terrace, and if so, how much more?
I think development on the lower terrace would have fewer effects on the adjacent O&L because it's separated to some extent. However, that development on the lower level could be quite visible from that Barker Road, so it's sensitive in that sense. Possibly I think there is capacity for some development that was well screened from the road and set against the escarpment. I wouldn't be able to say what numbers or extent.
Sherman Valentine. Next, any further questions? Any questions? Nothing from me.
One question. On the Sherman Valentine lot, if I may.
Yeah,
sure. The Gladstone Gap has got a modified linear stop bank in it,
which
you refer to. There was some debate as to how effective this would be, and obviously this may be well outside your remit, but in that it would stop if it ever got to the stage where there was a flood event and water encroached into that area. It would build up against the bank would fail, and you'd have a catastrophic flood as opposed to a slow creep. I don't suppose you've ever come across any discussion along those lines.
No, the only thing, it's not, you know, I don't have expertise on that, but I did read in Contact Energy's mission that I think they use it as a control, and so they may open that stop bank purposely to relieve pressure elsewhere in the...
Yes.
System, but that's all I know. Yeah.
No, there was, I'm just aware there was some discussion with regard to the Great Alpine Fault giving it a good nudge and how that could best be avoided. No, quite just an aside. Thank you.
My question on the same point is that given that the dam raised the lake in the late 1950s by in the order of 15 metres. And the Gladstone Gap is quite a bit above the water. It seems it seems incredible to me that the natural water flow would have gone through that gap.
That was my advice.
I certainly understand Commissioner Cloud's point that post dam, it was described as a fuse point, effectively. But naturally,
I'm not sure. I think my understanding was that in the past there was an outflow, but I'm not sure at what stage in the past, whether that was in a geologically distant past
or
in a recent past.
Yeah. Okay, leave that one there.
Human memory.
Willow Ridge at Ruggett. Mr. Hudson. Commissioner Cloud.
No, I think you've explained that very well.
Right. Nice one here. Wachtabu Holdings and the Alpine Group's problems aren't that's the problem. Wachtabu Holdings. Commissioner Hudson?
So just before we get to that, I didn't have any questions, but there was a burden submission at late and late land care before we get to Wachtabu.
I think Wachtabu was before.
Was it time to shot past it then?
You did.
For once I was up another right on it.
Oh, Dad.
No, sir, no questions from the office on that one.
Question McLeod?
Negative.
I have three questions. The first is your 890 spousal. You're talking about loss of rural character. The question I had was, well, with sawmill on one side and a game packing operation on the other, has the rural character already been compromised to a degree?
Yes, I think it has been compromised to a degree, and that's part of the reason why I have not supported this submission, because the proposed zoning exacerbates those effects. I still think there is rural character present here.
So you're talking cumulative effects?
Yes.
Now the next point is that result of the spread of vegetation along the eastern side of Church Road, the intersection with Shortcut Road, and Ms. Stephen says it's 65 metres from the northern part of the site to the intersection. And imagine she's got out and measured it in the glass.
There is the other factory, on the which is on the northern side of the proposed rural life, so that extends further.
So the factory in between. And lastly, have you been on the trail next to?
No, I haven't been on that trail. I wasn't unfortunately aware that it was on the same level when I visited the site.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, I won't ask the question that I was going to ask. Right, we have the Burden and Lake Spear Trust. Commissioner, did you have a question?
No, I didn't.
All right. Any more for anyone?
Thank you.
Rock and Iron. Coma. No, Rogers. Regarding Cadrona Village. Cutler and the Albert Town floodplains.
one key question. The legal road, that's the walkway that's on the top of the escarpment. This is the Albertson.
And
the 4.53 of your...
The walkway is kind of, it's at the, down at the river level rather than on the top of the escarpment. Then it goes up a little bit, kind of like halfway up the escarpment.
Yep.
Up to the... to the east, after you go under the bridge.
Yep.
Goes, yeah.
But there's a walkway on the bottom. There's also a walkway on the top.
Okay, yes, no, it doesn't include the walkway on the
on
top.
On the top.
Yes.
I was just wondering about the legal road. So I'm assuming that much of
the legal road extends beyond, to the north of the bridge. The legal road extends across the top of the terrace at the top of the escarpment a little way.
So if you're looking at photograph 21 that you've got in your evidence in chief,
yes,
that's the legal road that's in front of us there, is it?
Oh, on that side, that's the eastern side of the bridge.
Yes.
That's the walkway there, and
yes.
The O&L line that I've proposed is to the left of the at the top of that slope.
Gotcha.
Yep.
And that continues along to the top of the slope on the
other side.
Western side of the bridge.
Yes.
Yeah. And because there is a walkway that's on that at the top there.
Yes.
And that wouldn't affect the O&L boundary, obviously. No. That's fine. Thank you.
I think we might be at the end. I'll just check and see if there's any questions. I could only thank you for your assistance. So, like, we really appreciate the detailed way you've gone through these and given us a lot of information, a lot of issues to think about. But we know you put a lot of work into it, now, so we really appreciate your assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think on that note, at 3:25, we might take the afternoon tea adjournment and return at 3:40.